If you have any information about the disappearance of Alicia Navarro, please call the Glendale, Arizona Police Department at 623-930-3000. The Anti-Predator Project at 305-796-4859. Or you can contact me, Alyssa Fleck, at gonefromglendale@gmail.com. If you think you see Alicia Navarro, please call 911 immediately. Thank you. This is episode 2 of Gone from Glendale, Lured. If you have not listened to episode 1, I recommend you go back and do that now. This episode especially is not suitable for all listeners and discusses sexual violence toward minors and suicide. Arizona has a missing persons problem. Among all the United States, Arizona is somewhat unique in that it's covered with vast, sprawling deserts and nature preserves, and it's one of the few states that shares a border with Mexico. People in Arizona go missing in many ways and are often never seen again. Whether they're taken by human smugglers or traffickers, or wander away into the desert and get lost. Whether they disappear across the border into South America, or are moved out of state on a human trafficking circuit. Whether they come from one of the many indigenous reservations across Arizona or the suburbs of its glittering cities. In my research into the problem of people from all walks of life going missing in Arizona, I discovered one place women in particular were going missing was a stretch in Phoenix called The Blade, which was popular with sex workers. I bring this up about The Blade because I first heard chatter about it in the comments section of a YouTube channel documenting life on the streets in Arizona. Later, it was confirmed to me by an investigator that it's true, women do seem to have been disappearing from The Blade. I think it's important to note that this kind of information that I found in the YouTube comments is not necessarily the kind of information you're going to find in the local news. But it's still really important to know if people are disappearing from your community. I think we as a society have an idea of what human trafficking looks like. That it's something that happens in the shadows, in dark alleys, to those who are most down and out in our society. In fact, human trafficking can and often does look like a parent selling their own child to another adult for sexual purposes in their own home. It doesn't have to be an organized, sophisticated operation. It doesn't have to look like a drug cartel snatching up women and children in the middle of the night. You also see unsophisticated human trafficking operations that are essentially a group of high school-aged kids. In my research for this case, I found one such gang active in the Phoenix area who called themselves the Green Light Gang, and were really active on social media, particularly Facebook. They posted pictures of themselves with weapons and drugs, and at least one member of the Green Light Gang was arrested in a human trafficking sting operation. But if Alicia was taken against her will, was she lured by a sophisticated human trafficking operation, or just one person who gained her trust? From everything we know about Alicia and her life leading up to her disappearance, it's hard to believe she would leave with someone who hadn't gained her trust over a period of time. Did Alicia's geographic location contribute to her being a target as much as the fact that she was so comfortable online and generally vulnerable to being targeted by bad actors? Alicia struggles with shyness, anxiety, and social isolation. She's on the autism spectrum. It's also fair to say she's a budding genius with computers. So what is the character profile of someone who would lure her from home?
So let's just look at generics, right? Let's take Alicia's case out of this and talk generically about people that look for children online, right?
This is Trent Steele, co-founder of the Anti-Predator Project, a nonprofit anti-trafficking organization which has been working Alicia's case since 2020.
the reality is the people that do this and exploit children online, it can be anybody. And we've seen this through the online stings that have been run. You know, recently they ran one down in Florida with, I don't know, people may or may not be familiar with a sheriff down there named Grady Judd, who does these things all the time. And he always releases the stats and the identity of the people that they get caught up in these stings. And it's always amazing for me to read. And it's very sad because you get everybody from people that are employees at Disneyland that have access to kids all the time. You get school teachers. You know, in his most recent sting, he actually got a assistant chief, assistant police chief from the state of Georgia.
Whoever took Alicia was able to take advantage of something else that harmed every missing person's investigation during the time. The coronavirus pandemic was a window of time when people were vanishing, and nobody knew why and whether they were sick in a hospital or even dead in their homes. The police and other emergency services were spread thin and lacking resources for missing persons investigations. The Glendale Police Department and the Anti-Predator Project were flooded with tips and pictures of supposed sightings of Alicia. But behind the masks, it was nearly impossible to tell if it could even be her. In episode 1, I mentioned I'd be reaching out to everyone in Alicia's orbit, and everyone who has since become involved with her case, in an attempt to speak with as many people as possible. To that end, I've reached out to Detective Travis Darby with the Glendale Police Department's Cold Case Unit. I haven't yet heard back from Detective Darby, but I will keep trying. One person you'll be hearing from in this episode and in future episodes is Trent Steele. He's a former senior agent with the U.S. Secret Service and the co-founder of the Anti-Predator Project, a nonprofit anti-trafficking organization that got involved in Alicia's case once it became clear Alicia was not a runaway. But before we go deeper into Alicia's case, I want to tell you about another story. I'm going to tell you up front that this story is very difficult to listen to, and it involves sexual abuse of a minor. Therefore, you should fast forward about 5 minutes if you don't think you can handle hearing about this. This is a story about a girl who's not Alicia Navarro, but because we don't know the exact details of Alicia's disappearance, we can look to stories of disappearances that share some common characteristics to get a sense of the criminal profile of somebody who would abduct her. This story happened about a year before Alicia disappeared. In March 2018, a 10-year-old girl from Lakeland, Florida, who I'm going to call Jane, met a 23-year-old man named Jonathan Diaz Fundora on an app called Geeking. Jonathan also goes by El Yoni King Diaz. The Geeking app, which has since shut down, promoted itself as a place for geeks to meet and discuss their interests, or roleplay. Jane and Jonathan exchanged numerous messages through Geeking before they ultimately moved their friendship to Facebook. As the online relationship developed, Jonathan Diaz Fundora began to groom the 10-year-old to act out his sexual fetish of a daddy-dom, little-girl submissive relationship, according to court records. Jonathan would instruct Jane to send him nude and sexually explicit photos of herself. This is an example of an exchange between Jane and Jonathan that was found on Jonathan's devices, according to court documents. Jane: Daddy? Jonathan: Yes, baby. Jane: I-L-Y. This is the abbreviation for I love you. Jonathan sends back a heart and chicken emoji and says, I love you too, baby. Jane: How much? Jonathan: More than anything on this planet. Jane: I want to call you. Jonathan: Soon. In another exchange, Jane can't get a hold of Jonathan and repeatedly writes, Daddy, 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 trying to get his attention. It's heartbreaking to read these exchanges. We can see from their exchanges that Jonathan exploited Jane's absent parental figures and her desire to be protected and loved and to show off her accomplishments, for someone to be proud of her. Just 6 weeks after meeting up on Geeking, Jonathan decided he and Jane should meet up in real life. He instructed the 10-year-old to leave a note for her grandmother that she would be staying at a friend's house for 3 days. He told her to bring 5 of every article of clothing. Then, Jonathan, who had taken time off of work from the Burger King near his house where he was a manager, drove his mother's Honda Civic over 4 hours from Miami to Lakeland to meet up with Jane. Jonathan waited for her at the end of her street, and he took Jane to a Motel 6, where he put her in a dog collar and sexually assaulted her. Upon finding the note that she had left, Jane's grandmother called the police, who were able to quickly ping Jane's cell phone and trace it to the Motel 6. Upon being found with Jane at the Motel 6, Jonathan Diaz-Fundora was arrested and charged with sexual battery, traveling to meet a minor for the purpose of sexual battery, and kidnapping of a child under 13. It's hard to say how this might have progressed had Jane's disappearance not been taken so seriously and her phone not been tracked by police so quickly and efficiently. Jane was tragically assaulted by this man and would spend the rest of her life recovering from this. It could have ended with Jane's grandparents never finding her. In a police interview, Jonathan told investigators that Jane had told him she was 18, but based on her appearance, he believed her to be closer to 15. In fact, Jane was 10 at the time that Jonathan groomed her over Geeking and Facebook. Jonathan Fundora did not have a prior criminal record that I was able to find. Jonathan Fundora had dropped out of high school in Miami due to suicidality, but received his GED and then an associate's degree in culinary arts. On the witness stand, Jonathan's mother, who struggles a bit with the English language, described him as a sweet and simple but troubled boy who always lived in a fantasy land. She said she and the rest of the family still thinks of Jonathan as, quote, a little boy. Tragically, Jane was not able to move on from what Jonathan did to her. And according to the impact statements given by her family members on the record, Jane took her own life before Jonathan was brought to trial. Jonathan pleaded no contest and was sentenced to life in prison. When Alicia first went missing, Jessica explained that because of her shyness and social anxiety, Alicia would struggle to travel far on her own and not be able to navigate public transportation. But Alicia is very competent and highly intelligent. Whoever came to pick her up would have had to gain her trust if they were going to get away with this. Unfortunately, by the time police got involved, Alicia's phone could not be tracked. Neither could the computer that she brought with her, and as far as investigators have communicated, neither one ever went active again.
In Alicia's case, you know, everybody's aware that when she left, she took her cell phone and her laptop with her. So that alone, the fact that we don't have access to the devices, has made things incredibly difficult. The only information we're able to gather is what's been left behind, you know, in the cloud and online that we can follow. And unfortunately, that's just very, very small breadcrumbs. That doesn't give us the whole picture that we would have if we had access to the devices. So, you know, being everybody thinks that you can magically track a cell phone's location, that's not necessarily the case either. So
just to be clear, there hasn't been any activity from her phone since she went missing.
Correct. Despite what some media outlets have put out there, I can tell you right now there has been no activity on anything since the day she left.
Okay.
But looking to Alicia's social media and gaming devices has meant sifting through possibly viable leads and red herrings. Since we don't know where Alicia went, it's impossible to parse the red herrings. But when I look up Alicia's gamer tag on Xbox, that's the name that you always play under, whatever game you've been playing, I found at least one person that Alicia had been talking to. She had been talking and gaming with someone named Clark. I'm going to leave out his last name for now, so I'm just going to call him Clark and tell you that he's from Oregon. And it turns out I actually wasn't the only person interested in Clark. I learned that the FBI actually questioned him and searched his computers and devices. I got in touch with Clark myself and talked with him briefly for some of my earlier reporting on Alicia's case. I'm planning to get in touch with him again to see if he'd be willing to talk to me for this podcast. Clark is thin and Caucasian with dark hair and dark eyes. He has tattoos. Clark told me that he and Alicia met some years ago, but the message exchanges that Clark sent me between he and Alicia don't really make much sense. Clark told me based on his conversations with Alicia, he believes it's possible that she could have been struggling with something like schizophrenia.
Coming into this case after Alicia has already gone missing. So you've never met Alicia personally, but you kind of have to go into her mind, right? So when you came into this case and you sat down with Alicia's technology, you know, what you were able to access, what did you learn about Alicia? What did her use of technology tell you and the other investigators about her and what she might have been doing on the internet?
It's a trend that we've seen a lot in today's world, right? Especially with COVID coming into the picture, you know, in 2020, kids are spending a lot more time online. And, you know, I'm going to date myself a little bit and age myself a little bit here. But, you know, back in the days when we wanted to meet up with our friends and we wanted to do stuff, you know, we went and did it in person. And we went and we rode our bikes there. We walked there, you know. And in today's world, it's all done online. It's where kids meet each other. That's where they hang out. You know, and so we found out that Alicia had a very, very active social life. And that she spent a lot of time video gaming. And, you know, without getting into too many more specifics, just generically, you know, that's kind of what we found out, is that she was a very active young lady in the online world.
Mm-hmm. And in person, she might have been very shy, but she was maybe more open to talking to people online, which I think it's probably
correct.
Common of a lot of people of that age. I know that was
correct.
Well, when I was growing up.
Well, and not only that, right? Like in Alicia's case, we've got the autistic component that comes into play, and mm-hmm. and we've seen this with a lot of autistic kids before in the past, where maybe socially they're very, very awkward and they don't interact well with people face to face, but you remove that social component, that face-to-face component, and you put them behind a keyboard on a computer, and they kind of feel like they can really be themselves. And so in some cases, maybe you get a truer picture of kids like that from looking at their online activity, maybe sometimes than person to person. So that's another thing that we kind of saw, because we know that Alicia had some social interaction problems as well.
Despite her difficulty with social interactions, a piece of information came out during the investigation that Alicia's mother, Jessica, had not been aware of. Alicia was supposedly involved in a love triangle torn between a boy at her new school, Borgatti Catholic High School, and a boyfriend from the old one. Friends said once the boys found out that there was someone else in the picture, each ended their respective relationships with her. There's been some discussion about Alicia possibly having two boyfriends at the time of her disappearance. Do you think either one of them could have had anything to do with this?
With that, I can't really comment on that, because that's still part of the active investigation stuff. But I can tell you that law enforcement and us have spoken with everybody, but I can't really get into that whole theory, and because I know there's a lot of people out in the interweb, so to speak, that have lots of theories about that as well. But, you know, unfortunately, I just can't comment on that at the moment.
I want to wrap this episode up with a couple of thoughts. First, I want to note that I didn't share that story about Jane and Jonathan Fundora to shame or blame Jane's parental figures, just as I don't blame Alicia's mother for Alicia going missing. I know that Jessica has done her best as a mother, and it's obvious to me in many ways. I shared that story because it's important for us to know that these things do happen. And it doesn't help anyone to bury our heads in the sand and say, not my child. As long as the internet exists, all children are vulnerable to being groomed by predators. And it's gotten to the point where it's nearly impossible to block a child's access to the internet. And we can't force our children to share what's going on with them. By all accounts, Jonathan Fundora was not a genius. He was an ordinary person, and he was a predator. Next time, you'll be hearing more from PI Trent Steele, who has been working on Alicia's case alongside the Glendale PD since 2020. And hopefully you'll be hearing from Clark, one of Alicia's gamer friends that I found online. We will also be digging back into the weeks and days leading up to Alicia's disappearance, including the Friday she stayed home from school. How long had Alicia been planning this trip? We're going to try to find out. If this episode has left you feeling distressed and you're looking for resources, please reach out to the National Sexual Assault Support Hotline at 800-656-4673.
Please, whoever is listening to this, if you think you see her, please call 911. Wherever you're at, call law enforcement. Let them come out and deal with it. Don't wait, because there's very little that we can do. There's very little that Glendale PD can do if we're notified weeks and months.
If you have any information about the disappearance of Alicia Navarro, please call the Glendale, Arizona Police Department at 623-930-3000. The Anti-Predator Project at 305-796-4859. Or you can email me, Alyssa Fleck, at gonefromglendale@gmail.com.